Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The Michael Reed Show podcast. Tune in weekdays from 9 on LMFM. To contact us, email now, michael@lmfm.ie.
Monday morning, the 16th of January. Good morning. With much debate and discussion from now till 11 a.m, this is Michael Reed on LMFM. The far right is on the internet, telling lies about immigrants, stirring up anger in people, infiltrating local communities with racist, fascist propaganda that has resulted in the angry protests at immigration centres that we've seen over the last couple of weeks.
These are individuals, very, very small in number. They find influence through social media, and then they wish to bring out numbers through false information and creating fear and concern in the community.
The Garda Commissioner Drew Harris was speaking on Friday about some of the well-known internet warriors, if you like, who want immigrants to be sent home and campaign under the banners Ireland is full and Ireland for the Irish.
They are driven by prejudice, it has to be said, and we are very aware of that. We are very aware then of the risk to public safety and our responsibility in terms of preventing crime, gathering intelligence. They all come to the fore and we are conducting our inquiries as you would expect.
Indeed, these are well-known troublemakers who are stirring up hatred. Most of us do expect the Gardaí to be monitoring their actions.
Well, you have to look at the character of what's happening, and it is around individuals. And even to call them groups is probably not a description that applies. They are individuals who coalesce around others with similar outlooks, and they find each other on social media. And that we are not unique in facing this problem. This is right across Europe, and we've learned a lot of lessons then from our colleagues across Europe on how to investigate these matters.
And like those other far-right groups in Europe, the people driving an anti-foreigner rhetoric have sinister motives.
A small but sinister element are attempting to sow division in communities across our country. And whilst we did see protests, relatively small protests, in a number of locations last night, we also saw many communities speak out against those protests, say, that is not in my name. And we saw many people on a cross-party basis say, this is not in our name either.
That's the Minister for Justice, Simon Harris, articulating what we've seen here locally. People have concerns. No, it's not an ideal situation. Yes, there are many questions, but people for the most part understand the terrible reasons for immigrants fleeing their home country and coming here to seek international protection. And that's despite the campaign of hatred orchestrated online by right-wing fascist racists.
We are gathering information on individuals who, in the background, have a more sinister agenda and wish to use this for their own motives, and their motives are not good. Their motives could be described as being far right, and our investigations and inquiries are ongoing in respect of them. But again, we have to wait and see what happens. If there is a breach of the criminal law, then obviously then we will act in terms of reporting the matter to the DPP.
That's the Garda Commissioner Drew Harris. Once again, let's speak now to Jesuit priest Father Peter McVerry. A very good morning to you, Peter. Thanks for joining us on the programme this morning. We've seen ugly scenes in different parts of the country over the last few weeks, and Ballymun no exception to that, where you want to see an end to these type of protests outside of the places where people are living.
Yeah, I think the first thing is that many of these people who are seeking asylum have been traumatised long before they even came to Ireland. They have experienced that trauma, and these protests, which are happening right outside their windows and front doors, are re-traumatizing them again. And I think we need to, I think that is unacceptable. One proposal would be that there would be a 100-meter exclusion zone, such as we have or have proposed around abortion services, to prevent that sort of intimidation. People have a right to protest if they want. Of course they have, but they don't have any right to engage in threatening and intimidating behaviour right in the faces almost of the people they are protesting against.
Can you imagine the people in Kildare being told that somebody was going to burn the hotel down?
Well, somebody has been charged in relation to that.
Yes. But I just mean how people must feel inside these buildings when people are outside protesting and they've nowhere to go because this has now become their home.
That's right. Yeah, it's very frightening. And in the case of Ballymun, they were afraid to come out of their rooms. They were afraid even to look out the windows at the protesters. They felt very, very intimidated.
I heard one of the children
ask...
The far
right are leading this. This is not, and again... The vast majority of people in Ballymun have no support for that sort of behaviour at all. So it's been led by these small groups, and these small groups, they thrive on publicity. And if you had a 1 metre, a 100 metre exclusion zone, the publicity that would be generated by their protest would be much less, and therefore deprives these far-right groups of the fuel that drives them. I'd also like to remind them that Irish people have been are immigrants in pretty well every country in the world.
Yeah.
And their irony is that they are saying that these people, asylum seekers, should be thrown out of Ireland. The logical is that Irish people should be thrown out of every country in the world in which they have emigrated to.
Well, I don't know. I think the Irish probably have received a different welcome, certainly in most parts of the world, than the welcome that the immigrants here have received from this small cohort of people who are really causing an awful lot of trouble. I mean, I think you're probably talking about the potential for years of trouble in the mind of a child in Ballymun who asked if they were going to come in and shoot us.
Yeah, it's the consequences, the long-term consequences could be devastating, particularly for children. But hopefully these protests, these far-right groups are tiny. They're very, very small. They have no support. They're doing this to generate support by creating fears. I would say, you know, to those people who feed into the fears, if they do create fears among local residents, my response is the best way to get rid of those fears is actually go into these centres and meet the residents, meet the asylum seekers who are in there. Once you meet them, your attitude changes.
Well, there was a lot of fear in Termonfeckin up to last week about a group of residents that had arrived in the village, and we took the radio programme out there, met with the lads, all wonderful group of people who want to integrate as part of the community and want to work in the community, want to become friends with people if that's possible, or participate in local activities or sports. And they made all that very clear on the radio, and I think that brought people around. And during those conversations, somebody said that when groups come into localities like this, there should be a meet and greet to defuse the fear that people have, and indeed the suspicion that they have of the unknown, make the people known to each other.
That's right. Yeah, it won't convince the hard right.
No.
ideologues, but the fear is often the fear of the unknown, the fear of what could happen. And the best way to dispel that fear is actually to go in and meet the people. That changes everything. And again, if people feel respected, if these asylum seekers feel that they're welcomed, they're going to treat people respectfully. But if they feel that the community doesn't give a damn about them, the community doesn't want them, well, why should they give a damn about the community? So I think the solution is let's engage with the people, and that dissipates the vast majority of fears for most people.
Okay, there seems to be a pattern to the way these groups go about selling their message. They all say we're not opposed to genuine refugees. They use the same terminology for the people that they are opposed to, which is because they're men of military age and what are they doing here anyway, and all of this sort of thing. And then they talk about some of the social issues, some of the problems that we have in this country. You know better than anybody how severe the housing crisis is in this country. And we have these groups pitting one set of people against the other. And they're taking a situation that people are already angry about, and they're exploiting that, making people more angry, and then targeting that anger at those who are seeking refuge in this country.
Yeah, I think people are right to be angry about the housing situation, about the inability of the health service to meet their needs. But that anger should be targeted at the political system, not at the asylum seekers. That's totally displaced. But of course, they won't channel that anger towards the politicians because that's much more difficult to do. It's much more and much less effective than what they are doing at the moment. And they're not just targeting men of military age. In Ballymun, there are families in that hotel and children who were terrified at what was happening outside their window. So it's not just, there is this misinformation going on all the time. We have these men who are likely to rob you and hurt you. And as many of the Ukrainians now are working, I think it's 10,000 Ukrainians here who are actually working, paying, contributing to the society, to Irish society, paying their taxes. It's total misinformation that these right.
Oh, and downright lies on occasion. I mean, I think it's been said in a few locations that somebody who stabbed somebody in Killarney is now living in one of the refugee centres, whether that's in Termonfeckin or in Ballymun or the East Wall. And of course that's not true. I mean, if anybody steps back to think about something like that for half a second, it's not possibly true. Of course, if somebody did something like that, they'd be under arrest and in custody until they're tried for their actions. I mean, it's just absolute
almost
nonsense.
Almost every day in the papers we read about somebody being stabbed. Yeah. And it wasn't a foreigner who was stabbing them. It was some other Irish person who was stabbing an Irish person. So creating that fear is totally misplaced and totally unacceptable.
What is the motivation behind this vile hatred? What are these people seeking to get from stirring up such anger?
Well, I don't know any of them, so I'm not sure. But I think what they want is political credibility. I think they want to boost their political status and political acceptance or the knowledge of people of these right-wing groups. I think they would be hoping for, I think they may have already tried to win elections at local level, have been very unsuccessful. I think they're looking for political credibility and support from some elements of the public that might get them into political office.
And tapping into issues that are important to people, as the Garda Commissioner said earlier, this is happening across Europe. Conor Gallagher, the crime and security correspondent in the Irish Times, wrote extensively about these right-wing groups over the weekend, and he was reporting that there's links now with groups in the United Kingdom, a white nationalist group called Patriotic Alternative, and they're sharing ideas and they're sharing tactics. These are the kind of messages and the way they get their message across to people, that sort of, well, we're not opposed to genuine refugees, which immediately makes you think that the people they're protesting against aren't genuine.
That's right. And I think, I mean, we've always had these extremists. They've always been there in every society, in every age. But social media now has given them a platform to spread their ideology, to spread their fears, in a way that never happened in the past. And I think that's why we're seeing such a rise of extremism in many countries. We've seen it in America, we've seen it in Brazil, we've seen it in France, we've seen it in Germany, seen it in Sweden, seen it in all countries. There's this populist right-wing extremism has been growing, still very small, thankfully, in Ireland. But it is growing around the world, and the growth is funneled by through social media.
And what do you think to, what would you say to some people who think, well, you know, I don't want to be associated with that vile hatred that they're talking about on the radio, but there is a point to some of this. There's a lot of questions that I have, because I think there probably are genuine questions that people should be asking, because this is a huge challenge for all of us.
It is. There are genuine questions about the level of services that are available in this country. That question existed long before the Ukrainians or the large number of asylum seekers that we've seen recently coming. That's a genuine question. And the fear is it's going to get worse. You know, we have, we just do not have the accommodation for asylum for the level of asylum seekers and Ukrainians that are coming. 3 into 2 doesn't go. We simply don't have it. And I think that's a huge political problem. But the anger and that people may experience, the resentment they may experience at not being able to be housed, should be directed at the political system and not at the vulnerable asylum seekers who are not responsible for causing the problems.
And can I ask you, Peter McVerry, as a priest, how you feel about people who hate other people simply because the colour of their skin, their religion, their ethnicity, or because they were born in a different country. And not only have they got that hatred themselves, but they're inciting hatred in others. That would seem pretty evil to me.
Well, it is evil, of course it is. It's totally contrary to the Christian gospel and totally contrary to pretty well every organised religion in the world. Yeah, every religion in the world has this moral code. You love your neighbour. It's totally unacceptable from a moral point of view. And people who have that hatred and resentment at people coming into this country, they should not be allowed to call themselves Christian, and they should be called out by the Christian churches. And their ideology totally rejected. I'd like to see very strong statements from all the churches and from the other religions in Ireland condemning what these people stand for and what they're trying to promote. Because it is totally unacceptable, both from a moral and obviously from a legal point of view as well, I think.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much indeed for sharing your thoughts and opinions with us. It's very much appreciated. That's Jesuit priest Father Peter McVerry.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
Let's speak to Labour's spokesperson on finance, Jed Nash, who's a TD for Louth and Meath East. A number of issues to discuss this morning, but maybe we can take up from where we left off there a moment ago with Father Peter McVerry talking about these exclusion zones, safe zones, similar to what people would have heard about outside of abortion providers, that there should be safe zones of 100 metres outside of these buildings that are providing accommodation to asylum seekers. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I've heard the discussions about that. I didn't hear what Father McVerry had to say, but I would imagine that he may have been quite positive towards that idea. Firstly, I'd say, Michael, it's quite sad that we are in a situation where we feel that we as a society have to feel like we need to take those kinds of actions to insulate and protect people from some of the hatred that they have experienced over the last period of time, whipped up on social media, people showing up outside accommodation centres. Made the point over the weekend to individuals that I've been speaking to, local communities across the country, some of them say, after being whipped up by the Irish Freedom Party and others, with the vitriol that they've been spreading and the hate that they've been spreading, say that they are fearful of accommodation centres being established in their communities. But the truth is, and credit to you, Michael, for the coverage that you've given and the direct interviews you did with people like Ishmael and Max, who are currently living in the triple house. You know, most of the people who are experiencing fear at the moment are those who are fearful and confused about why communities are responding in the way that some communities have to the development of temporary accommodation centres in our areas. So, look, if that's something that needs to be considered, let's consider it. I think and I hope that the Irish people are better than that. There's a minority of people who have taken to social media and who have ramped up the rhetoric about asylum seekers and refugees over the last period of time. It's creating a lot of tension in communities across our country with mistruths, with misinformation, with disinformation, and that needs to stop.
Okay, what's happening in Termin Feachan? Because there was to be a public meeting, I think, over the weekend, and that was cancelled. And it seems as though some people had been asking questions, but they're not getting the support that they had expected to opposing the 42 men moving into the Triple House.
That's right. I didn't catch the first part of your question, Michael, but I think you referred to plans that a local group, I used the term advisedly, that was hastily arranged, set up on Facebook. They appeared to have plans to hold some form of a demonstration, demonstrating about what, I don't know, in front of 42 very fearful men. 42 men are here in this country for 42 very different reasons. I'm glad that they have reflected on that. They reflected on that, I believe, because of the community response and the fact that individuals and people collectively in the community said, look, this is not on. We need a different response. We need a welcome response. We need to understand why people come to Ireland in the first place, what they're fleeing from. We need to be a welcoming society. We will not accept the rhetoric of the far right who are just trying to simply exploit working class communities, and as usually working class communities, working class people, they seek to exploit. If somebody has got an issue, which I have, Michael, with the inadequacy of housing in this country, with the inadequacy of public services, then you know, take that protest to government, turf the government out, elect a new government, get involved in real political activism, try and change your community for the better. Don't scapegoat people who are even less well off than we are.
Yeah, and when you read this stuff on the internet about it being a banana republic, maybe remember your very recent history, which is one that recalls how many people died for the democracy that we live in, and we live in a very democratic country because we have the opportunity, as you say, to turf the government out if we're not happy with them. I was speaking on the programme last week as well about how some people in Termin Feachan have been arriving at the Triple House and bringing in some small things which have been very welcomed, like a set of golf clubs, because some entertainment and they're the kind of things that people can do if you've got a table tennis set or a jigsaw or something, just to entertain the lads. But the lads were also saying that they want to get involved in the community, in the environment, maybe in the tidy towns or something like that. That would go a long way, wouldn't it, in terms of people getting to know each other?
Well, that's right, and breaking down those kinds of barriers that have been, I think, artificially put up over the last period of time. Because, you know, and I'd separate, Michael, the the reaction to the creation of a temporary accommodation centre in our area. I break that down into a number of different groups. I think that there are people who are just genuinely looking for answers. What's happening here? You know, who are the individuals? What's, you know, what are they fleeing from? And what is the state doing from? People who are seeking to understand what's happening here are looking for a clear message from government. And frankly, the you know, communication from the department has not been what it might be, and I'd say that's been the case, that's been the experience of other local public representatives as well. And then you've got people who simply do not want to have people who don't look like us, people who don't have our culture, people who have different interests than us, people who come from different areas, parts of the world. They simply don't want them in their community. And that's sad. And that's a minority, a very small minority. A minority, I think, that's been sort of that message as well that they're spreading has been articulated and sort of magnified and amplified on social media because of the way that social media operates. And we don't hear, Michael, on the media about all of the people who have visited accommodation centres to engage positively with new arrivals to our community. People are bringing gifts, people are bringing things that people need. I know, for example, that a group is being formed in Termin Feachan, literally as we speak, to try to create a more structured response, we will say, to engaging with those who are living in the community now, who may be here for a little while, who should consider this area to be their home. They're having their applications for asylum in this country processed. They're entitled to be treated with dignity and respect when they are here. I mean, for example, there are people in Termofec, and I think yesterday, who are taking some of the lads in the centre who are living there now to the beach, for example.
No.
You know that Termofec beach is one of the most beautiful beaches
beautiful.
In the country.
Yeah.
An incredible resource that we have on our doorstep that, unfortunately, some people have said that they weren't really prepared to enjoy because they were fearful of what the response would be if they left the centre, and that's no way to live, and that's just simply not right. So so there are responses evolving now, positive responses to embrace this change, to manage this, and to make sure that people feel welcome and feel at home, and where local resources are made available to them, and they can enjoy the amenities that we all take for granted.
Yeah, and I know a lot of people have been asking me, do they need anything? I'm sure that anything that would entertain them, they definitely need clothes. I don't know if anybody would be inclined to install broadband for them, but I'm sure that would go a long way to making life a lot more pleasant under the circumstances, which are far from ideal. Far from ideal, I'm sure, for people in Termofec and for the 42 men who have just moved into the village, for that matter. Let's talk about...
Could I say, myself and my colleague, Councillor Michelle Hall, will be visiting the centre very shortly to engage, and we have been engaging all along, especially my colleague, with the centre, you know, trying to get an understanding of the experiences of the individuals there, how the centre is being managed and so on. And I think that's important, that public representatives as well show that kind of leadership. And I know this morning at the meeting of Loud County Council, Councillor Hall is bringing forward an emergency motion calling essentially on all public representatives not to be tolerant in any fashion of hate speech, of kind of intimidation that has been experienced in centres across the country. Those of all hues, democratically elected public representatives unite, and yes, call it for a better response from government, because what's happening at the moment is inadequate in terms of what individuals who are arriving in this country are experiencing, and the, you know, some communities are entitled to expect better information, better quality information, but we are in an emergency. What we need to see happen over the next period of time is the development of, you know, modular building, that kind of approach to ensure that people who are arriving here...
That this is a temporary situation. Yeah.
This is a temporary situation.
During an emergency, exactly. And we all pull together.
We at every level, we need to operate.
Well, I think when you're in the Triple House later on, you'll find that is not a place for any kind of hate speech, because the atmosphere is so laid back and relaxed and friendly. Just a nice bunch of lads. We were going to talk to you this morning about Damien English's resignation, and we'll do that in a moment. But this has taken a curious twist, with a senior minister now apologising for not following ethics legislation, and Pascal Donoghue, apparently during the last general election campaign in 2016, had six people put up posters during his campaign. A businessman, Michael Stone, paid those six people €1,100, which should be seen as a donation to the minister's campaign. And the minister has apologised for what he says has been an oversight. We'll hear just a little bit of what Pascal Donoghue said to reporters yesterday.
In retrospect, I should have amended my election expenses form at that point to take value of the €140 of the commercial value of a corporate vehicle for the hours used. This was a clear oversight on my part, which I acknowledge and apologise for. Having been made aware of the payment to the individuals in recent weeks, it is clear to me that the value of the labour provided to the amount of approximately €917 should also have been declared in my election expenses form.
All right, that's Minister for Public Expenditure, Pascal Donoghue, who oversees the work of SIPU, the Standards in Public Office Commission. Do you think the minister has done enough to put this to bed, Jed Nash?
We only know that, I think, over the next couple of days. This is, it's no point to me saying that this isn't concerning, Michael, it is. It's concerning because I would have been of the impression that Minister Donoghue would have been well aware of the years of his responsibilities in terms of declaring interests, donations and so on, that all public representatives, whether they're local or national, have to declare, in one case, the SIPO if you're a TD or a senator, or to the local authority if you're a local election candidate or successfully elected councillor. He was the Minister for Public Expenditure and Reform from 2016 to 2020. He is now Minister for Public Expenditure and Reform again since Christmas, when he was first made aware of this, what I might describe as an error, and that's the way he described it, in 2017 in relation to the provision of the van as a service. He put a monetary value on that and amended his statement to SIPO. Now it's come to light that, in fact, things have got even more complicated. The Minister ought to have been aware back in 2017. He may have been more curious than he seems to have been. When he looked at his returns again, he could have made an analysis then that, look, you know, this appears to be considerably more in terms of the value of a donation by way of a service, and I need to declare that too. He seems to be making the case that this donation, without losing your listeners, Michael, and there are differences here in terms of the thresholds applied in terms of what you declare and what you're not obliged to declare. He seems to be making the case now that this was a donation that was made to the Dublin Central Fine Gael Party and not to him personally. Now, that remains to be seen, and that's to be determined by the Standards Public Office Commission. And it's an interesting distinction, because that means the thresholds are lower for an individual than a party, or different thresholds. So we will see what emerges over the next period of time. But, you know, my concern here is that, you know, he's recused himself. He stepped back from any involvement now in the reform agenda. You know, in 2015, Brendan Howland, when he was Minister for Public Expenditure Reform, introduced what's known as the Public Sector Standards Bill. That would have given SIPO real teeth to investigate issues like this and initiate investigations off their own bat. As it stands at the moment, SIPO has to wait for a complaint from a member of the public, from an individual, before they can actually carry out an examination of the issues. There are a range of different reforms that Brendan Howland proposed. 8 years on, we're still waiting for those reforms to be introduced. The Minister McGrath, who is now Minister for Finance, was Minister for Expenditure Reform before Christmas, replied to me at the end of the year and said, we're going to bring in this new ethics bill that you've been looking for years in the first quarter of 2023. But now the Minister with responsibility for Standards and Public Office has, it appears, got himself into a bit of difficulty. He has decided to recuse himself from any engagement with the Standards and Public Office Commission outside of the engagement he'll have to have with them about his own complaints. Where stands now the ethics bill? Who's going to be responsible for that? This is urgent. I mean, we've seen a series of issues emerge over the
last
few months.
Pascal Donoghue, by the sounds of things, because he's recused himself from the workings of that. But it sounds like you want more answers. There's clarity needed on this yet. And it comes on the back of Damien English's resignation for not filling out a form correctly, forgetting that he had a house. The Dáil will resume on Wednesday. Will you also be looking to hear from Damien English?
I would support calls by other opposition members to request Minister English to make a statement. I think there are still some outstanding matters that would be useful for Deputy English to address. I mean, what we learned last week just is not good. It's not good. It's disappointing, quite frankly. And Damien himself has accepted that he has fallen short of the standards that the public would expect, and the standards that we're entitled to expect from ministers and public representatives. And he had decided he was right. He was correct to resign. There's no doubt about that. I mean, the first thing I thought about when I heard about this situation was the people that I work with on a daily basis in Eastmeath and the people across County Louth as well, who are seeking to develop reasonable accommodation for themselves in their own community and are always absolutely upfront and clear about what they possess in their own ownership and what their local need is and so on, and often, even when they go through those very challenging barriers that are rightly placed down in law and by way of regulation, they often find that they don't succeed in securing planning permission. So I think people across the county would be reflecting that, saying, look, that's not been, my experience has been difficult, my experience has been challenging, and
People have...
Well, I think people would like an explanation. I think people would like to hear from Damien English, and of course Damien English is welcome to speak to his constituents through this radio station, and I'm sure there's many other mediums who would be happy to facilitate an interview or to hear what the former minister has to say at this stage. We're over time now though, so we'll leave it there for the moment, and thank you for joining us on the programme this morning as always. Labour Party TD for Louth and Meath East, Jed Nash.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
We were talking about buses last week. Indeed, we were talking about them over the course of the last couple of weeks, a conversation that started with why the 100X from Dundalk to Dublin Airport is always late, a half an hour late, and I'm sure a half an hour late when it arrives in Dublin city centre. We did hear from a listener who told us that they'd called into the bus depot in Drogheda to ask about Stephen's Day service, and they were told it would be a Sunday service, and when they went for the bus there was no bus. They missed their flight and they lost a lot of money as a result of that. That same caller back in touch with us saying that the rules are made up as you go. This time the complaint is about the 101 service to Dublin because it also calls at the airport. However, if you buy a return ticket on the 100X, your ticket is not valid for the 101, even though you're using the same company for the same price to the same destination. On one occasion, my partner and I were coming from the airport, and as the 101 was available earlier than the 100X, we took it from the airport to the bus station in Drogheda. It took 1 hour and 40 minutes. I fail to understand the logic behind the fact that there are seven stops for the 101 in Balbriggan, which is also served by Dublin Bus. That's Paul in Drogheda, and thanks for getting back in touch with us, Paul, for that matter. I think there's certainly some questions about the reliability of some bus services and indeed the timetables that they're supposed to be running to. Somebody in touch with us saying that the demonstration, I think, in Ballymun was taken over by others with a national view, which drowned out of Carlingford, drowned out the people of Carlingford. Thank you indeed for that. I did see a text earlier on from the same person who was saying that they were part of a group of concerned locals who attended that demonstration in Carlingford in November. We're not right-wing or politically associated in any way, but we have concerns and there's a lack of communication and integration for refugees into local communities. I'm sure that there's a lot of truth in that, but go and knock on the door and ask to speak to people. It's a lot better than standing outside with tricolours asking people to go back to where they came from when we all know or should know that that's impossible. Anyway, let's talk a little bit about that appalling video. I don't know if you saw the video, but my God, it would frighten the living daylights out of you if you saw these fellas sulky racing on the M3. Nick Killian is the Cathaoirleach of Meath County Council and on the line. Very good morning to you, Nick, and thank you indeed for joining us. The Minister for Justice, it seems, was shocked by what he saw. I'm sure you were equally shocked. What do you make of what happened? Hello, Nick. No, we've lost the line to Nick Killian. I'm not sure if you have seen the video, but it was online. And there was a fella, the video came from behind the fella who was driving the horse. And my God, he whipped that horse so hard and so vigorously and so consistently that in itself was very upsetting to watch. But the idea of horses on the motorway late at night, the minister, as you know, has spoken about this, asking for anybody with information to come forward on it. We're trying to get Nick Killian back on the line. While we do that, I might go back to some more of the comments that have been coming to us. Michael in Navan saying that maybe of some of the anger should be at over how 7,000 social houses have been refused by people, which is disgraceful. People need to look at themselves before blaming the government for everything. Thanks for that, Michael. Patsy in Carrick says, in the late 50s and the 60s in London, there were notices saying no blacks, no Irish need apply. And do not forget all of the awful Irish jokes as well. Irish immigrants did not have it easy. There was a line missing from that Patsy. It used to say, no blacks, no dogs, no Irish. And in that order. Thank you for your text if you have been in touch with us. By the way, if you want to make comment, our telephone number is 0419832000. Text or WhatsApp 0861800658. Email michael@lmfm.ie. Now, I think we do have Nick Killian, Cathaoirleach of Meath County Council, on the line. And thanks for coming back to us, Nick. I'm not sure how the line fell out in us there, but thanks, as I say, for your time with us this morning. I'm sure, like all of us who saw that video, you were shocked by the scenes of sulky racing on the M3.
Unbelievable. And to think that it's happening on our national motorways, just really unbelievable. And the way the horses were actually treated themselves as well, totally unacceptable. It's despicable. And we all know sulky racing takes place, but what is on video is just, it's just horrible, and the poor horses. And, you know, the danger that this can cause to motorists, I know it was Sunday morning, quiet day on the roads, but nonetheless, people could have been travelling.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive and June. Olive and June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Horses can do lots of things and run across roads, do anything and create an accident and kill somebody. But these people don't seem to care.
I'm sure you'd echo what the minister said about somebody coming forward with information, if they have any, to try and get these people in front of a judge and maybe see fewer incidents of this very, very dangerous behaviour.
Well, I hope they do, and that somebody may have dash cam evidence. And if they have, please bring it to your nearest Garda station and show it to them, and let's see what we can do about this. I also see Minister Pippa Hackett is also calling on our government colleagues to stop this behaviour. How you stop it, I simply don't know. If people do these sort of things early in the morning, on a Sunday morning, we can't have guards everywhere, but this is not acceptable, totally unacceptable. It's creating road is breaking every law that's there from a road safety perspective, and the motorists are being put in danger. Not acceptable.
Well, that's it. I mean, it's so dangerous. Really isn't acceptable. Thanks for making comment on that. You're joining us this morning to talk about applying for planning permission. This follows, obviously, the resignation of Damien English as a Minister of State for forgetting about a house that he was the owner of, or at least he didn't fill out the form accurately to reflect that this house existed. Is that something that happens regularly, or how does it happen, or how does it go unnoticed for as long as it did?
Well, obviously, I'm not going to comment on David Inge's situation whatsoever, other than to say that there is a process, and the present process for applying for planning
in County Meath comes in under the County Development Plan, Section 9 of the County Development Plan. It's a very strict process, it's a very open process, and it's a very transparent process, because once you apply for planning application, anybody or any member of the public are free to go and look at a particular file. There are two reasons for giving rural planning. One is what's called housing need, and the second one is local need. And then there's all the technical reasons then for why the planner should give planning. My best advice to many people who come to councillors for advice in relation to planning, and that's all we do, is give advice, because at the end of the day, it's the planners who make the actual final decisions in relation to each applicant. The situation is they need a set of planning maps, which they can get from the Ordnance Survey Office in the Phoenix Park. They should then make an appointment and do pre-planning. And I would say to anybody listening to the radio this morning and to you this morning, Michael, is do pre-planning. Get advice from the planners. They're there, they're open, they make themselves available. And from a Meath perspective, we're very good at giving advice out through the planning section of the council. There's a set of plans and guidelines that people can look at from a design perspective. The other obvious, very obvious one is a septic tank. I always say to people, well, if you can't pull the chain, you can't build the house. So that's another aspect that has to be dealt with as well within the planning process.
Right.
So, With good architects, with good architectural technicians, particularly those that live in Meath, who understand the Meath local authority. Sometimes Dublin architects don't have the same handle on how we operate in County Meath or in a rural setting. The strict guidelines are there. They're there for everybody to apply. And as I said, it's an open and transparent. It's because you or I can go in and look at any file, Michael, at any time, as you know.
But are applications taken in good faith? Is it as simple as that?
They have to be taken in good faith, because they have to be. The forms have to be filled out. The questions are asked. The opportunity is there to answer that question in the most truthful manner possible, and that there is. Goes to the planner, and the planners take quite a, you know, if you go to a pre-planning, one of the questions you will be asked is about your housing need and your local need.
Mm.
Your local need is that you're from the rural community, or that you live within 5-7 kilometres of where you're actually applying for. And to be fair, in County Meath, I think our average grant is around 60% of all one-off rural housing. I could be incorrect on that, but it's in or around that figure. So many people obviously apply every year and are granted. And yes, there are those who are refused. And they're refused for various reasons. Possibly the siting of the actual house, the fact that maybe the percolation area is not acceptable, is not at the acceptable level to the local authority. The actual design of the house. But there are guidelines and there's help there for people.
Is there consequences, though, if people make false applications or inaccurate applications?
A refusal.
Okay.
That's the one. And then, of course, people have that opportunity that if, for example, Meath County Council refuse a planning application or to grant the actual application, people then have the entitlement and can go to Ombord Planála and appeal the decision of the council.
Well, if in this case Damien English had been forthcoming and told the council that he had this house in Castle Martin, he'd have been refused planning permission, as I understand it. And you said you don't want to talk about Damien English, and that's fair enough. But if there's a well-known individual in the locality who makes a planning application, do people in the planning office not say, does he not have a house up the road? I mean, this is very local stuff, and people have been asking us that question.
Well, you must remember that, you know, in Meath County Council, we have a planning section where we have actual planners. The planners are not from... Not a lot of the planners working in County Meath are not from County Meath. nor do they live in County Meath. So they're not going to be aware of where Nick Killian or Michael, you know, lives, you know. So from that perspective, questions are asked on the actual forms. So it's based on the actual form itself. And that's where the decision comes from. And if you go to pre-planning, you will be questioned about your housing need and you will be questioned about your local need.
Okay, and should there be a greater, should there be a separate consequence? I mean, if you are granted planning permission and you shouldn't be granted planning permission because you've incorrectly filled out the form, should there be a consequence for doing that, you know, when it gets past the idea of permission, you've been given permission because, as you explained, it was the only consequence is a refusal.
Well, I don't know what other consequence could be put in place.
Retrospectively, when there's something like this is discovered.
Well, we're in a situation at the moment where the rural planning guidelines, they were meant to be published this time last year by the former junior minister, Peter Burke. We have a new minister in place now, Kieran O'Donnell, in that particular section. And we're waiting on the rural planning guidelines to be published. If people, or if government feel, or if the feeling out there is that there should be some sort, let's do it through the rural planning guidelines. So there is that opportunity there. I believe that they have been drafted.
But if you fill out the form knowingly wrong, there is no consequence unless you're caught out, isn't it?
That's true, Michael.
Yeah. Let me read a quote to you. A person building a one-off house cannot afford to be cheeky with the council or to take any risks. These people face the full rigour of the law and the council comes down on them if they step sideways. Unquote. And we can attribute that quote to Damien English when he was a Minister for Housing. But it's not true. The council doesn't come down at all on you. The council does nothing once you've been given permission. Isn't that true?
Well, I'm not aware of any fine or way of giving people some sort of... I'm trying to find the word. No, there's not. Not that I'm certainly aware of. And I'm around a long time dealing with planning. And the objective of every applicant is to try and get that planning. In relation to getting it or not, refusal is the bottom line. And refusal, now, if you get a refusal, you can go back in again, depending on the actual severity of the planning report. A lot of people don't listen to the advice that they're given either by their architect or indeed by their local county councillor, and they go bullheaded in and still lodge the application. And I always say to people when it's refused, read the planning report, which is an extended report. It's not just the actual list of reasons why you were refused, which is in the refusal letter that you get from the council. If people read the planning report, they are then given exact reasons as to why a particular application is refused. So the information is out there. As I said, it is a transparent process from the public's perspective. Anybody can go in and look and check a file. But in relation to putting some sort of...
Sanction,
that's the word I was looking for, Michael. Sanction. I'm not aware of it. But I think there is an opportunity through the new rural planning guidelines that if the people feel that way, that they can do it through that particular process that's gone through government at present.
Okay, we'll leave it there for the moment. Thank you indeed for joining us. As always, that's Nick Killian, independent councillor, and Cathaoirleach of Meath County Council.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
49-year-old from Drogheda, Gerard Cruz, as you know, pleaded guilty in the Special Criminal Court last week to facilitating a gang that carried out the murder of Keane Mulready Woods in Drogheda 3 years ago. He's obviously going to spend time in jail now after a plea that was similar to that of Paul Crosby for the same reason. Another man, Gerard Jed McKenna, is also in prison after admitting to cleaning up the crime scene in Rathmullen Park. where Keane Mulready Woods was murdered, quite possibly, Gardaí say, by Robbie Lawler, who himself was shot dead in Belfast in 2020. Let's speak to local Sinn Féin TD for Louth and East Meath, Imelda Munster, who's on the line. And a very good morning to you, Imelda Munster, and thank you indeed for joining us. I think people in Drogheda will sleep all the better knowing that Gerard Cruz follows Paul Crosby behind bars.
Yeah, I think it will give people some comfort that they can now see the people have been arrested and charged and held to account for their actions and face the full rigours of the law. I mean, that will offer some comfort to people, because the people of Drogheda went through hell during that feud, constant fear and trepidation. And it's actually still hard to believe that if it got so out of control or was allowed to get out of control. I mean, even when you think back, you say, God, did that actually happen? We'd shootings in broad daylight. We'd dozens of homes firebombed. We'd mothers terrified and traumatised. We'd children that couldn't play outside their homes in some areas. You know, and personally, I'll never forget to the day I die the mothers I met in my office. I mean, they were in such states of distress that it's hard even to put into words. Mm. Mothers that couldn't even speak. They were so traumatised, broke down instantly as soon as you sat down with them. Every bone in their body shaken. They'd been threatened with knives. They had their guns. They had their homes attacked. And even, I remember one incident of a mother threatened with a chainsaw at our front door. You know, it was just horrific. And even looking back, you actually think, how was it ever allowed to get out of control, as out of control as it got, you know?
And that, I think, probably was something that was obvious, no matter what you were doing in Drogheda at the time, because there was this constant hum of the Garda helicopter hovering overhead, it seemed, almost all of the time. With these key players in this feud now off the streets, do you think that Drogheda is a safer town? Is this feud over?
I mean, you'd love to hope against hope and say that it is, but I just have a fear that it's not the end. There's been a recent spate of attacks. I mean, when the feud was at its height, you had the spotlight, the national spotlight, focused on the feud and focused on Drogheda. And you had the Garda efforts, and you had the additional Gardaí and the rapid response force, I think, or rapid response unit. And as you say, helicopters and all of that, and all effort was put into it. And then you had the lockdown from COVID, which helped insofar as it meant things were relatively under control, or it quietened down. There was fewer attacks and threats or fewer extortions. But things are starting to kick off again with recent arson attacks. It seems to be simmering up again. There appears to be new gangs forming, and that's how it started originally. There was no attention paid to it when it was simmering there, when there were incidents, and it appeared to me, and I said it at the time, that a blind eye was being turned to it. But, you know, there needs to be the same focus, the same round-the-clock surveillance, because a resurgence of it and these new gangs and the arson attacks and that's the last thing we want to see, and it's the last thing that should be allowed to ever happen again.
And a recent and very brutal murder, for that matter. Keane Mulready Woods' murder was one of the most gruesome horrific murders in living memory in Rathmullen Park. Murder, it would seem, in Rathmullen Park, that of Brian Reynolds, attacked by four men with hammers. You want to know why that's not a murder investigation at this stage?
Well, it appears, I mean, to have all the hallmarks of a murder, you know, and I'll be intend to meet with the chief superintendent due to the rise, you know, the incidents of late, but also just to see what exactly is going on, because as I said, you know, this can't be allowed to build up and kick off again the way it has. And for that reason, we need to know that the Gardaí are across everything. They need to be all over this, every single incident investigated fully with a thorough follow-up. so that people can be reassured that this will never be allowed to happen again. I know it's a constant fight with, you know, a constant battle with drugs, but the feud and the gang war, that has to be curtailed and literally smashed.
Well, there's been no impact from what we hear in terms of the drugs trade in Drogheda. The feud may have died down and some of the better known gangsters dead or in prison or on the run. But the drugs are there and there's new gangs coming up. We have had this brutal murder of Brian Reynolds and that would appear to be linked to local gangs. And we've had these petrol bomb attacks in Scarlet Crescent, in Nuns Walk and on the Ballymakenny Road. Do you believe that they're linked to the drugs trade?
I would believe that there has to be some form of link. I mean, there were homes that were attacked mistakenly, that the, you know, they'd absolutely nothing to do with it, but obviously others were. There was a horrific incident outside Drogheda just before Christmas, a home attacked and the family have fled. But again, it comes back to Garda surveillance and whether they're smaller drug dealers or the you know, leaders in the drugs gang or whatever they are. As I said, the guards need to be all over this and clamp down on it and, you know, thorough investigations, thorough follow-up all the time to make sure that it never reaches the horrific heights that it did. And I am just worried when you see the attacks becoming more frequent now that, you know, it is kicking off again. And that's where we need to know the Garda's plan of action, because we can never, ever endure what we endured during that feud.
And we were promised so much. People of the area were promised so much following the murder of Kemal Reedy. There was a huge march in Drogheda, a big demonstration. People demanded action. Every political leader in the country was there. And it was all going to happen. Drogheda was going to be prioritised and so on. Are you seeing any evidence that work has been done on the ground so that this would become less of a policing issue, that there would be less in the way of the drugs trade, that people would be convinced at a younger age, preschoolers, primary school children and so on, that there would be reach out projects for them?
Well, I know work is underway. Have we seen the actual results of that at the minute? Not visible results, I would say, at this stage, that you can see. Now, I know there was an apprenticeship program that's up at the Dunor Road there. I was at the launch of it. That was a good initiative to get younger people who are, you know, have dropped out of school, no interest in school, you know, that they could have an apprenticeship type of thing. And there are the community groups working hard at ground level, but there needs to be a whole lot more done, you know, to get children to not to take drugs, not to succumb to what you would see as bullies in the community that would kind of, you know, put pressure on them to sell their drugs and all that sort of thing. There's no visible evidence of that yet. But again, the Gardaí have a crucial role in monitoring all of this and being on top of absolutely everything that's happening, who's dealing, who they're, you know, they're getting it from, who's the supplier, all of that sort of thing. They need to be right across that. Because I work in Leinster House, I'm often going up O'Connell Street early in the morning, and you see it's totally out of control in Dublin. You see young people, totally ashen-faced, looking 20 years older than they are, skin and bone, teeth missing, ravaged by drug addiction. It's often like a scene from The Walking Dead, and I'm not exaggerating when I say that.
No, I know.
They're dealing openly outside the GPO. And as people, I've often watched it walking past and looked behind me then to see, did I actually see that? They're actually openly dealing outside the GPO. And as people collect their payment, their social welfare payment, there's fellas just standing around and you actually see them handing whatever it is.
As if nobody can do anything about it.
Young fellas on bikes scouting the area. Now, you often see that level of addiction on a much, much smaller scale in Drogheda. But I know I've often walked over West Street and looked at someone and said, what on earth are they on? You know, that you could, and we can't allow it to take that hold in Drogheda. And that's why I say guards have to be all over this, you know, literally right across it. They should, with all the surveillance they've gathered and all the intelligence and information they've gathered throughout the feud, they should now have a, you know, a pretty good picture. But I know there's new gangs forming, but they need to be on top of that too and see who's dealing, where they're getting it, who's the main supplier, you know, and those starting to carry out attacks. It seems that they're starting to grow in confidence again, that they think they can, you know, kick it off again.
Okay.
And that just can't be tolerated.
No, okay. Let's hope that it isn't. We'll leave it there for the moment, though. Thank you indeed for joining us today. Sinn Féin TD for Louth and East Meath, the Mel and Munster.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
A survey from the Society of Chartered Surveyors of Ireland has discovered the shocking fact that 40% of residential property sales in the last quarter of last year were landlords selling up and leaving the market. Let's speak to Mary Conway, who's the chairperson of the Irish Property Owners Association. A very good morning to you, Mary, and thank you indeed for joining us on the programme today. I do believe that that is a shocking statistic. Are you surprised by it? I know that it's prompted you to call on the government to act urgently in a way that will incentivise landlords to stay in the market.
Good morning, Michael. Thanks for having me on. No, we're not a bit shocked, and we have been saying it for ages. And even in our pre-budget submission, which was back in March, when we did a survey of our landlords, 57% of our landlords in the rent pressure zone planned to sell in the next 2 years. And I think that was back in March. We're looking at the figures now of sales in the last quarter of 2022. And I think the reason that the numbers probably appear a bit higher there is because the landlords were hoping that there was something going to happen in the budget that was going to keep them in the market. It didn't happen. And now we have rising maintenance costs, mortgage interest costs, and no means to offset it. Everybody's stuck in a rent pressure zone. So I think the numbers will possibly be higher in the next quarter.
Right. Okay. Do your members feel as though they were misled by way of what was said in the run-up to the budget?
Well, we were confident we would get something out of it, but all we got was something that really didn't make much difference to many landlords, which was got to do with pre-letting expenses. And pre-letting expenses really will be for a landlord who's coming into the market, and we know for a fact there's nobody coming into the market.
Right. And what are landlords doing if they sell up? Are they investing in different ways?
They're not. No, they're just... Well, a lot of them have very little left at the end of it, if they've anything at all. A lot of landlords would have bought it. You know, these would be self-employed guys, your carpenters, your plumbers, that don't have a company pension, and they bought a property knowing that they could do the maintenance themselves and hoping that, you know, when pension time would come, that they would have something out of it. But a lot of those guys are cashing out now as well, because they're subsidising their mortgages, subsidising their tenants, and, you know, leaving themselves short. So it's just a lose-lose for everybody.
Right. It sounds dreadful. How is it so dreadful when the reality of it is that somebody else is paying your mortgage?
Well, somebody is contributing to your mortgage, but I won't necessarily paying your mortgage. And then you have all the other costs on top of it. So if you have €1, you're paying anything between 51 or 53% back to the government. So out of that, you have 47 cents left to pay your mortgage, to pay your tax, to pay your other expenses, if it's an apartment, if your maintenance, you know, your fee to the management company, you're paying your insurance, and a lot of landlords are subsidising it from their own private income whether it's, you know, out of their PAYE.
Why though? Why do they need to do that? I mean, if rents are so high, like locally, it's 1,500 on average for a three-bedroom house or 2,000 in Dublin. Are they paying more than that in mortgage repayments?
Yeah, some of them are. I know personally, my mortgages have gone through the roof since September with tracker interest rates. It's got really high and I'm paying, I wouldn't like to say how much, but I'm paying a shocking amount over what I was paying before. And the interest rates are still going up and I don't know how I'm going to sustain any of it.
Mm. And the rent that you're receiving doesn't cover the cost of the mortgage?
Just about. Mm. But I have to make cutbacks in other areas. So if, you know, things need to be...
Is that not a great deal? I mean, when you compare yourself to the people who are renting, they're getting nothing back in return for their money. Dead money is what renting used to be described as. You end up with the asset. You end up in full ownership of the property.
In a lot of cases, the assets were bought at very high prices at the Celtic Tiger days. Mm. And in some cases, they haven't even come up to what landlords paid for them.
Okay.
And there are rents, you know, everybody talks about the high rents. Rents are stuck at 2% right across the country. The only rents that are going up are the new properties that are coming into the market. And we know that the new properties coming into the market are mainly the institutional investors because they're not private investors coming in. And our members have properties right around the country in every city and town and village. And we just know from listening to them how much they're squeezed. And we know that some of the landlords haven't put up any of the rents over 10 years in some cases. And if a new tenant comes in, they are stuck at the same rent. So there's very little room to do any kind of a refurbishment or get it ready for a new tenant.
Okay.
Because the money just isn't there.
All right. There's obviously something in what you're saying. If 40% of all property sold, residential property sold, was sold by landlords in the last quarter of last year. And you've called on the government to incentivise people to stay in the market. What needs to be done? Do you want to be treated like institutional investors?
Because that would be lovely, because then we wouldn't be paying any tax at all.
Mm.
We'd like that everybody would pay a fair share of tax and not keep the burden on the small landlords. Really, the whole thing here is the failure of the government to build enough social housing, to build any social housing over the last number of years. And small landlords have been providing, yes, they've got assistance from the HAP scheme, and that has been a lot of money over the years. But, you know, the housing needs to be built and free up housing for other people who are coming in, for example. A lot of companies now are looking at overseas companies who are working in Ireland, looking at how are they going to bring in their workers.
Okay.
So everybody has been squeezed right through, from people being homeless to people coming in to companies. You know, at the moment, I have huge demands to find housing for guys who are working on the children's hospital, and we already know the slowdown there.
Mm.
So the whole system is completely dysfunctional and needs to be looked at, and a bit of creative thinking.
Okay, we'll leave it there for the moment. Marion, thank you indeed for joining us on the programme today. That's Mary Conway, chairperson of the Irish Property Owners Association, the IPOA. Now, some comments when it comes to the gangs and the drugs. Light touch policing, says Breda. The public have what they wish for, and the answer should be up against the wall and exterminate them. Thank you indeed for that. Another text from David Finnegan, who says there's a certain element of dearth that followed these marches around Water Charge, marches Croke Park against concerts. These so-called people don't even live in these areas, and David obviously doesn't have much time for them, given the other things he says that I can't read out for you on the radio. Ellen says, Michael, RTDs and ministers are a disgrace every day. There's another discovery of something that needs to be changed, and the record wasn't right, but they seem to keep their big salaries and their expenses, and at the same time there's people dying on the streets. Another text or WhatsApp message from Tom, who says, get the commentator and the other 159 TDs out of the Dáil. They're out of their depths, and that is why we have such poor services in this country. Thanks, Tom, for that. Somebody else wants to know about the repercussions following the incident with Damien English and what's going to happen. Well, I think the repercussions will be that that will be down to the people of Meath West to decide how they vote next. But thank you indeed if you have been in touch with us. If you haven't been in touch with us, as always, our telephone number 0419832000, text or WhatsApp 0861800658, or email michael at lmfm.ie.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
Now, given the increase in the cost of living and all of the pressures that there are on government, retired school teachers are worried about the value of their pensions and are calling on the government to maintain parity between teachers' pension payments and salaries that are paid to serving second level teachers. Susie Hall is the president of the North East branch of the Retired Secondary Teachers Association, or STA. And a very good morning to you, Susie, and thank you indeed for joining us on the programme this morning. And I know that you met recently with some of your colleagues locally, and there is some concern that there's a threat to your pensions.
Well, of course, pensions are always under threat, as you know. And, for example, during the FEMPI legislation, the government dipped quite heavily into our pensions, and we lost a great deal of money, which most pensioners couldn't afford, you know. But at the moment, and for some time past, pensions are linked to the salaries of serving teachers on a percentage basis. Now, obviously, they don't get the same salary, they don't expect it. But that is a safeguard for us, because if teachers get an increase, then the pensioners would likewise. But if that link is broken, it would be a very serious threat for retired teachers, because if their pensions remain static and the cost of living is shooting up, as you know, it will make life very difficult for people relying on pensions as their sole income source.
Right.
You know?
And is it just that experience has taught you to be cautious or cynical, or is there something that makes you think that there's a threat to that link between working teachers' pay?
No, but you see, it's always a threat, because at the moment we have assurances that the parity between the salaries of serving teachers and the pensions of retired teachers will continue for the duration of this pay agreement. But that's only a one-year pay agreement. And so every time a pay agreement is negotiated, that's always at risk. Now, we have sought, along with the Alliance of Retired Public Servants, of which we are a founder member, we have sought to get representation when pay talks are in train. So far, we haven't succeeded, but we're not giving up on that. Because, you see, once you're retired, you're not like a serving teacher. You can't withdraw your labour or anything like that. And, of course, I know that there's a great deal of talk in the public arena about, you know, gold-plated public service pensions. But nothing could be farther from the truth for many, many of our members. Firstly, a lot of our members are women. And many of those were obliged to give up teaching when they married or had children. I myself lost my job when I even said, I didn't actually do it, but I said I was getting married. I had got engaged and I was let go from a permanent job, because you could do that in those days.
My God.
So, yes. So therefore, as your pension is linked to the number of years you have been teaching, we have some teachers on very, very poor pensions altogether. Now, in the social welfare pensions, of course, the government does, from time to time, they're not over-generous either, but the government is conscious of the need to, you know, upgrade those from time to time, and they do get the double contribution at Christmas and that sort of thing. But retired public servants are not eligible for those pensions.
Mm. And have very little, as you say, in terms of combating what you might perceive to be threatening.
Well, there's nothing they can do, really, yeah. You know.
But you are organising, and I think you're looking to hear from retired teachers in the North East.
Oh, yes, we are constantly, I mean, the RSTA, we are very active and we lobby government ministers. And as I say, we were founder members of the Alliance of Retired Public Servants, which is open to all retired public servants. And it's a very large grouping. And we are constantly lobbying just to maintain parity. You know, our demands are few. But you see, if you're in a teaching job, you have your trade union to represent you. But once you retire, you still need a lobby group of some sort or other to try to defend your pensions. And that's why we encourage all retired teachers to join the RSTA, because, you know, they will find there, apart from the advocacy and the lobbying and all that, which we do on their behalf. But it's a nice social thing as well. We have 18 branches around the country, and those branches organise outings, cultural trips to the theatre or the cinema. They organise walks in the country. They sometimes organise overnight trips away and so on.
I imagine there's great collegiality and a meeting of like-minded people, that sort of thing, as retired
and
teachers.
You see, there are many teachers who are widowed or divorced or were never attached in the first place. And their social life circulated around their school. You know, schools have a great social life attached to them. But once you're out of it, all that is gone. And, you know, as we all know with COVID in recent times, it can be lonely.
Okay, I'm running out of time, Susie. If people want to make contact with you.
Yes. They should look up the website, which is www.rsta.ie.
Okay.
That's www.rsta.ie.
That's Retired Secondary Teachers Association, rsta.ie.
That's right.
Susie, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the programme today. Susie Hall is the president of the North East branch of the Retired Secondary Teachers Association. Maggie McGuire researched today. Chris Murray was in the control tower. I'm Michael. God willing, we'll see you for our next programme tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. right here on LMFM. Good morning. Bye-bye.
The Michael Reid Show podcast. Tune in weekdays from 9 on LMFM. To contact us, email now, michael@lmfm.ie.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.